Hello.
Hello, this is Arnold.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you well. Can you hear me?
I can, perfectly. Thank you.
Great.
Well, I panicked because when I didn't get you on the phone at noon, I went back and looked at my records thinking, oh, no, I've messed up again. I have the wrong date. I have the wrong time. I'm always confusing it. And then in that email, I saw that my phone number had a typo. So I thought if you had tried to contact me by phone, you would have failed. So I apologize for that.
That's okay. I'm glad we're talking now.
Me too. I hope you're okay.
I am okay. I'm good.
Yeah. Are you sure you're up for this?
Yes, yes.
Okay, good. Well, I want to thank you for making time for us to speak. Sorry I've never had occasion to meet you in person. But I certainly know of you and have followed you with great interest. And I'm happy to have you in my collection of abstract drawings.
I'm excited to be in it. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, you are an artist. I mean, the breadth of your artistry can take us in many directions. And I don't think 45 minutes will give us enough time to cover all of it. But I'd like to dig in and see what we can put forth here. I found a statement someone made referring to you as a shaman, a showman, a trickster, historian, and poet of material.
Wow.
I thought, well, that kind of sums up your artistry. Uh-huh. Can we look at that together?
Sure.
And if you have an aversion to this statement, then please say so. But so how are you a shaman?
Okay. I think that has to do with me helping people to see things that they might not normally see, or directing people to directly look at things that might be invisible. I think that also relates to my interest in abstraction and to the works in your collection, which those drawings relate to a work, some works of mine, some paintings, two series of paintings, but maybe one that's less known is a series of small paintings that I called Vampires. And they were velvety, the surface of them was a very velvety, non-reflective black paint with a kind of Barnett Newman-esque zip down the middle of them. It was easier to see what was happening in those paintings if you looked at them from the side instead of looking directly at them. And when I called them vampires because when you look at them, you don't see your own reflection in them, but you're looking at something that's a little hard to see and definitely difficult to photograph. They were black on the surface, but if you looked at on the sides, there was obvious evidence of the color that is underneath the black. And I called the color on the side of the painting the action. The action was on the side of the painting, not in the front of the painting. I think the shaman also refers to This also refers to the works in your collection, is that I've tried to use the color black in my work, but not just as a color. I've tried to use it as directly as a color, as a reference to race, since I'm a black person, and also as a reference to a kind of magic. I'm not exactly sure who made a statement about shaman. It's very interesting. But I've also done a lot of teaching, and in several of my classes or some of my seminars I've taught in Portland and Richmond, Virginia, and now in Chicago, I like to have students start the class with a kind of a meditation where they might bring their yoga mat to my class and just lie on the floor and let go of all the stresses of the day and all the stresses of the studio so that we can then sit together and have a conversation in a kind of a fresh way. And I don't really lead them through a meditation. I just ask them to quiet down and follow their breath. And then sometimes as they're lying there, I will lecture about whatever's on my mind of that day. I used to have a student who never brought her yoga mat to my class, but she'd bring a fur coat and she'd lie on the floor in a fur on a fur coat. And I never asked her why. I just let students do their thing, you know. I think it's important that artists get to do their thing. And it didn't bother me that she was lying on a fur coat. But one day she said to me, "Do you ever wonder why I'm lying on a fur coat?" I said, "No, I don't." And she said, "Well, I wanted you to know I'm rich." I'm like, "Well, great." Whatever you need, whatever, like...
That's where she's comfortable.
Yeah, whatever helps you make your work. I do want the students to know who they are. That helps artists to be the best they are, figuring out who they are, whether it's through yoga or astrology or psychotherapy or religion or meditation or yoga. It's like, it's important that artists try to figure out who they are so that their art is coming from a real place. And I was very proud of the work of this student who also needed me to know that she came from a wealthy family. I don't know why she needed me to know that, but it was interesting.
Well, it sounded like she was just owning it. That was her reality.
Yeah.
And her life experiences stemmed from that position.
And she also wants to come to the shaman with all honesty.
Yeah, exactly. I what you're saying really interests me, Arnold, because I know it's important to you to be really free. I mean, you talk about having freedom to produce your work, freedom in the work. And I was curious how you impart that with your students, because you are obviously very loyal and committed to education, to academia as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this day and age, it must be a real challenge to help students to connect with themselves and trust themselves.
It is harder than it was not even long ago. It was easier to help students to be free. I think that, I don't know. I mean, I do know, but I used to do very unusual things with students that I don't think we're in a climate where I can do that, those things anymore. When I say things like that, I mean, I used to, if I had a student who was thinking too much, who was just caught in their thoughts, I would say I have a friend who's a hunter, and we're going to go to his farm and we're going to shoot guns today. I can't do that right now.
No, no.
So I think
you could go fishing though, Arnold.
Yes, meditation and mindfulness might be helpful. Walking. Exercise. You know, I like to think about a painter like Alex Katz,
mm-hmm.
who is quite elderly in some ways, but he runs every day. He has a very, and plus making big, big paintings is such a physical act that you actually have to be in physical shape to make the paintings at the size that an Alex Katz works in.
Mm-hmm.
If you can have sort of freedom in your body, maybe then you can have freedom in your spirit.
Mm-hmm. And, makes sense.
Yeah.
What about play in this context? I often talk to graduate students about the freedom to play, to experiment, to mess around,
mm-hmm.
without thinking of who they are and their artistry, without thinking of a finished product. just let curiosity take over. I see so little of that now, and it's a grave concern. And I think for me, the urge is to get to the same place that you're trying to get them to through yoga and shooting guns and these other kinds of activities. It's that, and that's where freedom comes from.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we're talking a lot about education, which I didn't know if that's what you wanted to talk about. But
well, no, I mean, I want, it's an aspect of your artistry that I think is important.
Right. I in my classes, in my seminars, I like to ask students to, you know, we do look deeply at their work, but at some point when I want them to play, when I see they're stuck, I say, I want you to make a work that is definitely coming from you. It's about your work, but I want you to work in a medium you've never worked in before. And then this will get painters to do performance, sculptors to make videos, performance artists to make paintings, because I'm asking them to specifically work in a medium that they're not used to working in, but to make a work that is really their own. And that exercise, which I learned from my mentor, an artist named David Hanna, this is an exercise it's a real revelation for most of my students, have their real breakthrough there. Another assignment that I give in my course is that might be a 15-person seminar, and I will divide the group into three groups of five people, and I will ask each group to create a collaborative installation or performance. And this is also always revelatory, because I mostly work with graduate students, and many of them are very stuck in their studios.
Mm-hmm,
and
for
they
sure.
Do not think about collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite competitive with each other, which is a healthy competition, and supportive of each other. But then to deal with inspiration and really, so that really takes the rug out from under them. It's another moment where they get to really explore who they are,
mm-hmm.
and what their work is. And I have to mention my mentor, David Hanna. He's an artist, actually makes a lot of work on paper. He shows with Gallery Paula Anglim in San Francisco. I don't know if you know that gallery.
Uh-huh.
They show Jess, they show Bruce Conner. And David, I think, is another artist. He's not really well known. There isn't a big market for his work, but he has had a profound influence on many great artists through his teaching as a professor at Stanford University.
Spell his last name for me.
Hanna, H-A-N-N-A-H.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I was hearing it correctly. Well, Arnold, it seems to me that your artistry has developed from that, this space.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, thinking about space.
I meant space metaphorically, in this place of experimentation, of play, of freedom. Can you go back to your earlier years? When did you first identify as an artist? When did it begin to enter your life?
I think it seriously began to enter my life. I mean, I think as a child I drew, and I could go back into long stories about making secret drawings that none of my family could see, usually under furniture in our house. But I would go to, I think, eighth or ninth grade in high school, where I was at a point where I could have gone into sports. I was I used to be a very good long distance runner. I'm not a fast runner, but I can run for a long time and I can just keep going. Or I could have started taking art classes 3 days a week at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston after school. So, and I chose to go into this program. It was 4 years of me taking classes 3 days a week after school from ninth grade to 12th grade at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston. There was a ceramics teacher, there was a painting teacher, and a printmaking teacher from the Boston Public Schools. It was a program between the Museum of Fine Arts Boston and the Boston Public Schools. And I would go to these classes after my high school classes. I was taking art in eighth grade, like everyone I think in my school had to do some sort of art. And some students were chosen to go into these classes and go into, I think, advanced placement art. And I wasn't chosen. And I had several friends who said, this doesn't make sense, Arnold. You really should be chosen. And we actually think it's racist that you weren't chosen to go into those classes. So it's complicated, but I went to visit. There was a teacher who wasn't my art teacher at my high school. Her name was Mrs. Teresa Craddock, and she's a black woman who I never had studied with. I was never in her classes, but many of my friends had, and they told me that Mrs. Craddock was great. And I went to Mrs. Craddock, and I said, I wasn't chosen by my teacher to go into the classes at the museum, but I really want to take them. And I think it's actually for a racist reason that I wasn't chosen. And Mrs. Craddock got me into those classes at the museum, which I went to religiously. And many of my friends stopped taking them so they could take driver's ed. I didn't even take driver's ed. I just kept taking art classes. I was so serious about it.
Can you tell me what, just stop for a moment and tell me what kinds of things you were making?
There we would do things like some copies of works in the museum. Like I tried to look at an Indian miniature, and I believe I made a drawing of it. And then I tried to create that Indian miniature in relief and to do a sort of plasticine relief of that Indian miniature. I really love looking at that. I really love looking at a painting by Cezanne called Madame Cezanne in a Red Chair, which I think is very influential to me. You know, we worked in different mediums, printmaking, paint. We would make work from our imagination or from observation there. And this was high school.
Mm-hmm. And you were responding to all of it?
I would rather do that than do sports or drive. I really.
But the medium, it didn't matter. You responded to whatever medium you were engaged with artistically.
Yes. Yes, uh-huh. Definitely.
Did you see your work in the context of the work that you were seeing produced around you, or did you see yourself more independently?
I really found some independence there because I got very curious about art. And although I was going to the museum as a high school student 3 days a week, every day, felt like every day, mm-hmm. I would also take time to go to galleries and go to the Institute of Contemporary Art. And I think shortly after graduating, I saw a very influential exhibition for me was called the Binational. And it was my first experience with contemporary art, like not sort of Rothko or Ellsworth Kelly or other things I was seeing at the museum, but real contemporary artists like Mike Kelly, Lorna Simpson, Jeff Koons, many people. It's a very influential exhibition to me. I've tried to meet many of the artists who were in that exhibition. One of them just died, Tim Rollins from Tim Rollins and KOS. He was part of that exhibition. But
can you be more specific about what you took away from that exhibition? Were there some specific moments?
I think that's where I saw that there was some sense of freedom and independence. Like the theme of the show, The Binational, was just emerging American artists. So each artist really was just presenting their own work, their own vision. There was no sort of overarching theme that I can see. You know, is it possibly the only exhibition that Lorna Simpson and Mike Kelly were in? Like, if you think like how, I mean, Lorna studied in L.A., maybe she
did. Gave you permission? Do you think it fortified for you?
Well, it gave
you... You could be who you wanted to be?
Well, it gave me a sense that there was freedom out there. And if it gave me an idea that if I didn't find it in Boston where I grew up, that I might find it somewhere else.
Okay. And so you were maybe aware of a larger universe of...
I was becoming aware of a larger universe, but I was afraid of New York. I ended up in California. After college, I kind of went directly to California where no one knew me, and I could create myself again.
I have so many questions. You know, I feel stressed that we only have this short time, but... Two questions come from this dialogue at this moment. One is the influence that moving around and having experienced different parts of the country, different cultures in those parts of the country on your work. And two is where did drawing fit into all of this?
I actually learned to love drawing in Boston at the museum school, and the person who made me love drawing is also a professor who once told me that he said, you're too smart to be an artist, which really, really offended me and made me push my work, to actually deal with ideas and concepts. But he said to me, you're too smart to be an artist, but he really did teach me to love drawing, and I love teaching drawing. Although I'm an abstractionist, I can really teach figure drawing. And I can teach people to understand abstraction in relationship to the figure. And I get really turned on about teaching drawing. I forgot your question.
Yeah, well, there are so many. That was part of it, and we could go off on the drawing. We'll come back to that. But I also wanted to know, you alluded to, you know, leaving Boston and going west, and I know that you've been in Portland, and you've been in Virginia, maybe? I can't remember.
And
Chicago. Mm-hmm. Now you're in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So you moved to all of these various centers, and some major art centers, some outliers. But moving around and interfacing in academia with those communities, how did it impact your own work?
It takes a while for me to settle into a place, but then I think that the place does have an influence on the work I'm making. Sometimes it's about having access to facility, or it could actually be a cultural influence. Living in Virginia was unlike anything I'd ever experienced. I do have to say that Portland, Oregon really felt like home to me. There was and home being, to define that, just a place where I could be for a long time with people I love, and with everything around me that seemed to be fueling my artwork at that time. Virginia brought some new things for me to look at, sort of the influence. I guess it was already there, but sort of underneath the sort of ghostly, haunted aspect of my work really started to come out in Virginia. I would say in Chicago.
Well, that's interesting.
I've really started to find a kind of an art family here,
mm-hmm.
which means like curators and writers who really want to support my work. You know, I think in every place I've been, I've always found the family of artists, but in Chicago, I found the family of artists plus critics and art historians and curators who are interested in my work. And it's funny, you started the conversation by calling me an artist, and I've heard that a lot in Chicago. And there was something, a local art magazine called New City just published an article on the 50 artists in Chicago, 50
yes,
of the top.
I saw it, yes.
And I was one of them. And
yes.
That artist is a tricky word, you know. If another artist calls you that, it's quite a compliment.
of course. Well, there's no denying it where you're concerned.
Thank you.
I mean, you represent ultimately what an artist should look like. That all of these, everything you do is related. And it all comes from your being and from your life experiences. And it has integrity. That's an artist, I think.
Yeah. I owe a lot to my parents. I just want to say that on this recording.
Were they involved in the arts at all?
No, they were not.
Or musicians or?
No, and I don't think they wanted me to be an artist.
Mm-hmm.
But when they saw that was my vision, they, like my father, eventually said, "You know your business," he said, which was his way of saying, "I trust your vision." He did not want me to be an artist. And my mother didn't think I was a very good artist, she told me. But it made me focus, I guess, more on this vision I have for, which is about freedom and about looking at things that are very personal and very real. And I feel that even though I look at things that are very personal, that it somehow relates to, in some universal way, to others. That's a very complicated paradox. Like, I'm not trying to make a work that has a universal language, but somehow I find that by looking very personally at what I do.
And that's what I seek as the observer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I believe that my aesthetic is fed by my unconscious mind,
mm-hmm.
based on all of my life experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And when I connect with a drawing powerfully, not just visually, but intrinsically, I trust that I'm connecting with something in the life of the artist on the other side through
mm-hmm.
that work. And I find it over and over and over again. It's real. Your humanness somehow and your experiences somehow generate something through the work that then I pick up. And not everyone is going to pick up on that. It depends on how our lives, our paths cross.
Right.
And it's once you make that discovery, I mean, when I made that discovery about that possibility, then everything changed for me. And mm-hmm. so that's what I look for in an artist. And that I have to rely on my response, trusting that it's a human-human connection. I don't have to know what that is. I just trust it. And it's powerful. I want to just go back a moment. If you were to revisit the drawings you were doing under the sofa, are there hints there of what you were dreaming of, what you aspire to, what you've become? Are there seeds there?
I guess that might be for someone else to find. I mean, these were my earliest drawings, some of my earliest memories. And I think if anyone were to look at those drawings, they might not know what they are because they are really the hand of a child.
But you know what they are.
I do know exactly what they are.
And when you go back and look at them, Do you have them?
One is under a chair in my mother's room, and it's more figurative. But when I say figurative, I mean in a childlike way, like a circle for a head and circles for hands. But it was a portrait, a full figures portrait of Batgirl and Robin with little masks. I remember they were wearing little masks. And the other work is under the dining room table and a little bit painted on the legs using white out, a very abstract marks, very abstract white paint on a dark surface under the dining room table. Which is, I mentioned that thing about masks with the Batgirl and Robin because I have been working a lot with masks in the last few years.
Using aluminum foil, right?
Aluminum foil, yes.
Where'd that come from, the foil?
I guess I'm thinking about reflective surfaces and mirrors and like those abstract painting vampires, how they weren't mirrors. And I guess trying to think through the process about reflectivity and mirroring and sort of the narcissism of the mirror, many things. But in a kind of way of trying to get away and break out and maybe have fun, as you said, to play a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I just started making objects or making images in aluminum foil and then putting them on a photocopier and making these prints with a photocopier that then I would hand embellish with watercolors that I would make myself to make each photocopied image really a unique image. And from doing that sort of digital process and trying to get my hand more involved in the digital and also wanting to make things where people could really see my hand, especially after making such minimalist works, such as the Daydream Nation series or Vampires.
And
I wanted to make things where people could see my hand. And the way the aluminum foil really responds to everything you could do to it, and there's a record of that, became really important to me. And in the new work, there's no digital. It's all hand, where I'm making an image in aluminum foil and then inking it directly and then pulling a unique monoprint or a monotype off of the aluminum foil.
And then coming in and on top of it again with the hand?
No. I think that after the print, I haven't worked into them again.
So they read more like a drawing.
They are like drawings. Mm-hmm. And actually moving the aluminum foil around is, that's my drawing mind, my drawing hand, mm-hmm. shaping that aluminum foil into an image.
Mm-hmm. I've always responded to their texture, the
yes.
aluminum pieces. More than the reflection, I respond to the texture.
Yes.
And it's physical. They take me mm-hmm. to a physical place.
There's something magical in the new prints where...
I haven't seen those. Have you showed them yet?
No, but I will be really soon. I'm working
okay.
on three solo shows right now, but the new prints...
You have another one that just opened, too, don't you? Didn't you just open a show somewhere?
Did I just open a show?
Are you in a group show somewhere? I just remember. And I know you have another one coming up in Portland.
Yes, I have a solo show coming mm-hmm. up in Portland.
Are you going to show those in Portland?
I'm going to show those in Portland. And I think mm-hmm. before that, a group show in New York, where
mm-hmm.
I'll have three of them in a group show at a gallery called Klaus von Nixhagend.
Hmm.
But some of these new works, the aluminum foil through the process of printing, it can actually look like lace. It's very hard.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I can almost envision it.
They're really beautiful.
Well,
and
I believe in
beauty and work.
I want to talk to you about close looking, too, because I think that's something else you and I are both interested in, this slow, close looking. And you
yeah.
alluded to that in your what was the other series you just talked about? We have to look at from the side.
The vampire
series required close looking.
Mm-hmm.
Close observation. I think that whole movement of slow art is an important one.
Yes.
To get us to really look and not just glaze over.
I think those things that you have the close looking at, it, those are things you go back to again and again. And longevity is quite important in art. That persistent, even if it's a small image, that it persists in your mind, that it when you go back and look at it, you might think, oh, when I was, like, I guess like, the Madame Cézanne at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. When I look at it now, I'm having this moment in the present, but I'm also thinking, I've been looking at this since I was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think you start to remember where you were in your life when you first looked at something, or the second time or the third time. And I'm also someone who brings other people to see things that I think are amazing. I'm like, oh, let me bring you to this piece. Let me bring you to Picasso's Portrait of Gertrude.
Well, you want to share that feeling. You want to share
yeah.
that experience.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you went back to the Cézanne piece, because I wanted to ask about that. And there, again, is a sample of a life experience you had that stays with you and keeps informing the future.
Right.
And that's the magic, really. I think that's terrific.
I think for younger artists, it's, you know, I'm not a younger artist anymore, although I still have a lot to learn. But I would say that resistance and persistence are really important, to continue to look at the things that are interesting to you. And that's what's kept my work going.
And, you know, Arnold, that applies to a collector, too.
Mm-hmm.
I've had to be really persistent and insistent to be independent and free as a collector, to see through my own lens and
yes.
not be dictated by what others tell me I should be looking at
mm-hmm.
or what I should own. I think it works for both of us that way, or at least for me it does. Which
yeah,
takes me to another question, and I'm skipping. We could delve into all of these with much greater depth, but you you're a big fan of McShine and the curator, and you've said that you think he should really be studied and written about. And I found a quote of his where he said, "A serious public cannot depend upon the whims of commercial galleries. It has to depend on museums." Now, I don't know what date he said that, but I wonder if you have a reaction to that.
He said a serious public.
He said a serious public cannot depend upon the whims of commercial galleries. It has to depend on museums.
Well, I wonder what he's is he talking about what is going to be history, what's really going to last? And he's talking about, well, who is looking for that? Is it the museums and the museum curators, or is it the gallerists? It's very interesting because I think like an artist like Fred Wilson.
Yes.
There was a moment in the market where the market was looking for something new. And they found an artist like Fred Wilson who was showing in the galleries off center, you know, galleries in the Lower East Side and the East Village and above Midtown, and definitely not
in the mainstream.
Not in the mainstream. And the commercial galleries were, oh, that's new. That's the new thing. Fred Wilson. And Fred Wilson as an artist has had such an influence on museums. And so it's I can't really, you know, these mechanisms for what becomes history or what lasts, I think the commercial galleries make it very complicated that they are having an influence on the museums now. But I think that really, I would say it's a visionary move of a gallery like Metro Pictures to start working with Fred Wilson.
I remember Fred Wilson from Mining the Museum in Baltimore.
Yeah. Fred Wilson once said to me, there are artists who are supported by grants and residencies, and there are artists who are supported by the galleries. He didn't think the two, when he said that to me, he didn't think the two could exist at the same time. And he's made an interesting move, I think, from, I don't know. I mean, he's represented by Pace now. It's one of the biggest galleries in the world. But he still has this sort of independence and definitely has benefited from winning awards or grants. It's something I'm trying to figure out myself, honestly.
Well, I think he has evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been steady and has steadily risen, but not necessarily with the flash and the, you know, the spark and the fury that we're seeing so much of.
I think museums' interest in him made him more desirable to the commercial world.
So it happened in reverse.
It happened in reverse.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe he was showing with a gallery like Metro Pictures, and then museums, Kinnison McShine put Fred Wilson in an exhibition called Mining the Museum at MoMA. And then the Venice Biennale for Fred, and then mm-hmm. he gets represented by Pace Gallery.
Yeah. And it all happened over a long period of time in his natural growth and development as an artist.
Right.
He was given, I mean, the benefits of his development in this regard, as you speak to it, is that he had time to really think about his work and think about what he wanted to create, without a lot of pressure.
Right.
So, interesting. Well, I wanted to ask you about that. I want to go back to where we began, and we did this shaman. I want to talk to you about the showman.
I wonder where this quote came from. So
I don't know, but I'm happy I found it because it's given me.
It's really challenging. You know, the shaman, the showman. I'll say this.
Well, they're very different, a shaman. You described the shaman really well, I think. So tell me about the showman.
They're different, but they're related. You know, I think you would be very careful about anyone who says, I'm a shaman. Or very careful about anyone who says, I'm a showman.
Well, we're taking this a little tongue-in-cheek, right?
Yeah. But the people who would say those things, you really should question, is that real?
Well, is the showman referring to your performance art? That's not trivial.
It's not
That's important.
Trivial. The performance is very important part of my practice, but really the way I do it, I really, because it's so special to me, maybe one performance a year, I really keep the performance a bit on the down low. And I wonder if people are talking about the my public lectures or the way I teach.
Oh, me?
When they talk about showman, because I'm actually introverted. I wouldn't say shy, but introverted sort of person. I don't even like to have my photograph taken. But the showman, that's really interesting. I think, you know, I'm really...
Well, showman, I guess, has different connotations.
Yeah, in communicating. I think it's about communication.
Okay.
And in communicating, I just try my best to be clear.
Well, you are very articulate, clearly.
And sometimes I have gone to great lengths to be clear. If the words aren't working, I'll move my body. I will show an image. I will sing. I will do what needs to be done for the communication to happen. And maybe that's
where that makes sense.
Showman is.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I see that as very positive.
Sure. I also want to refer to something that makes me think about a very important sort of performance I did at SF MoMA, where they had written to me, emailed me, they asked me to come to San Francisco to maybe read some poems in front of a work by Mary Heilman. And a few days before I was supposed to arrive, they sent me an email, said, we know we planned this, but like the painting's not on the wall. Whoever owned it needed to take it back. And so I came to the space. I said, well, we're not going to cancel. I'm still going to come. We're going to do something. So I told them to print out or make photocopies, black and white photocopies of that Mary Heilman painting. And when people arrived in the space, about 50 people or more showed up, everyone got a copy of the painting, but the painting wasn't on the wall. And so I explained to them that the painting wasn't here, but I'd like them to join me in helping make it appear. I told them I would turn my back on the audience and I would count to 100. And I wanted them to look at the image that they had received and focus on it to try to make that painting appear. And I literally turned my back on the audience and was silent and was counting backwards from 100. I turned around at some point, and the painting wasn't on the wall, and I told the audience that their faith in art wasn't strong enough, and that is why it hadn't appeared. I got a standing ovation at SF MoMA.
Well, and I bet people looked at that closely at that image that they had in front of them, more closely than they ever looked at a painting before or any image.
It was a standing ovation from
That's amazing.
The
there you go.
Crowd. of the San Francisco.
Well, I'm going to use that as the example of the showman.
It's a little bit of both. It's the showman and the shaman. I got like 50 people to meditate with me.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing.
Mama, on a painting that wasn't there. Mary Heilman, like a master of abstraction.
Brilliant. It was brilliant. I wish I could have been there. So I'm going to skip over to Three Walls because now we're talking about space and no painting in a space. And you've just gone on the board of Three Walls in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really curious what that's about.
Okay, Three Walls is a interesting organization, especially for this current moment. I mean, they've had a mission for a long time to work with a diverse group of Chicago artists, to support Chicago artists, to bring diversity to the Chicago art world. And now in this very moment, when the entire staff of Three Walls, which is a very small, very scrappy organization, are artists of color or people of color. The entire staff is not just people of color, but entirely Black. The board is majority people of color. This small organization without an exhibition space is supporting artists to make work in their communities. Three Walls, right after I joined, got a $1 million grant from CERTNA to re-grant to Chicago artists, especially artists of color. You know, I come from As an artist, I do come from what we call the artist space movement, which are spaces all over the country started by artists to support artists, which means artists not waiting for curators or gallerists to give them shows, but artists creating space to have their own shows. And I'm just continuing that work with Three Walls.
Okay.
Three Walls, thankfully, doesn't have an exhibition space, but they're bringing art to communities in Chicago by Chicago artists, mostly people of color and especially women.
Well, I was interested because I had read that part of its mission was indeed breaking down walls.
Right.
And, you know, it's a metaphor for a number of things, but I thought that was very powerful.
One of their programs is called Breaking Bread, where they invite people to a dinner that's held in a space that Three Walls has for conversation about culture and art. And I guess, you know, obviously politics as well.
Well, I'm curious. It's interesting that we're talking about Three Walls and what that work right after having talked about what happened in SF MoMA.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a relationship between them, which I find really fascinating.
Yes, yes.
That's very cool. Okay, I'm running out of time, but I want to get through this. We have trickster, historian, and poet of materials left. You want to pick one?
I don't know if I'm a trickster. I like that.
But look what happened with showman. We did some digging and we came up with some really good reason for showman.
Or
so,
the way people showed up at SF MoMA thinking of the food poems about some painting that wasn't, the painting wasn't there. They really didn't know. I mean, that's a bit of a trickster moment. Or
your earlier work too, where you were trying to hide the idea and make the viewer find it. That's a trickster, right?
Sure. But I think I'm trying to combine some of these things so that we could get, you know, being a poet of materials, not being afraid as a painter to do a performance or to make a sculpture, to make a mirror, to make shoes. Many things that I've explored in terms of materials, taking drying lemons that I've used in my kitchen and then spray painting them silver so that they look like cast aluminum. That's sort of the poetry of materials I think people are referring to. I mean, I will use silver paint in the work like it's alchemy, to paint coconuts or bamboo and mm-hmm. give them this heightened sense of value. Or really, you have to really look sometimes, but there are dried lemons that have been painted in some of my sculptural work. But I also believe in a realness of materials. Like, I will start working in bronze soon. I'm talking with a fabricator about helping me to enlarge some of the objects I've made and to make them in bronze. But I've explored materials like leather and textiles trying to think of all the things. Aluminum, of course.
Way you use paint. And you talked earlier about the surface of the paint being velvet. And
right.
Mm-hmm. Materiality is so important.
I have some very early works that are me as a young artist thinking Rothko was the greatest thing and me mm-hmm. trying to make these small watercolors mm-hmm. that were reminiscent of Rothko. And people always look at them and they're like, are those prints?
Yeah.
But they're so processed. They're so done. So many things have been done to them that they are simply watercolor that I put through many, many processes in order to make it look like a Rothko or make it look other than a paintbrush.
To give you the feeling that you wanted.
Right.
Let me ask you two more questions. Everything is being abbreviated, but it's all come together kind of beautifully, I think. You know, there's a clear understanding of who you are as an artist evolving here, and it all fits together quite beautifully. As the director of the graduate program at the Art Institute, is there something you really aspire to achieve there that isn't happening in academia elsewhere?
True support for young artists and I try to bring to students, I say, diverse examples of excellence from the faculty to the visiting artists to other students in the program. Diverse examples of excellence is what I'm interested in, and real support for students in their experience and their education. When I was at Virginia Commonwealth University, I took on a class that had been passed through many different professors' hands. And the year I arrived, it was really badly handled by another professor. So I took it on the next year. It was a course in professional practices. And that course actually came with a little bit of budget. And in the past, professors had used the money to take the students in that course to New York City to go to museums and galleries. And I did that once, but on top of that, I also brought them to some of the top collectors in New York City. They met some of the top curators, some of the top artists. I wasn't just galleries and museums. Like, I really pushed to make it the most I could make it for students. And that, I'm always thinking students need to get more than what they think they're paying for. The second year I taught that course, on the first day, I said to the students, I know you took this course because you think we're all going to New York, and I just want you to know we're not doing that this year. And I watch the students get very quiet and their heads looking at their hands and at their feet. And then I said, this is the trickster. I said, but I hope that you have a passport because I'm going to use the money I would usually use to take you to New York to take you to Mexico City. And for the same amount of money as 3 days in New York, we spent a week or more in Mexico City.
How wonderful.
We went to the top artist studios. We met the top curators. We went to museums. We went to galleries. We had cultural experiences. We ate at some of the best restaurants. Some of the students were invited to do exhibitions of their work in Mexico. It really, I try to bring more to the students than what they think they're paying for. And regrettably, students are paying a lot of money for the MFA degree.
Mm-hmm. And not getting the kind of experience firsthand that you're giving them.
Right. And at VCU, the dean, I have to be honest, he said, why did you take our students to Mexico City? Why did you do that? I'm like, well, they got so much more for their money. For 3 days in New York, we spent over a week in Mexico. They were driven around by a private driver in a van everywhere we went. They had such an... One of the students said to me, this week in Mexico City, I learned more than my entire 2 years at the school.
Well, those were life-altering experiences for them.
Right.
No doubt.
Some of them had never been out of the country. They had never even been to New York City, so this was major for them.
Which leads me to my last question. What has been a seminal moment for you in the advancement of your career?
It hasn't happened yet.
Fair enough. It's going to happen at the Art Institute, huh? When you make this happen.
I used to say being in freestyle at the Studio Museum in Harlem, that was one seminal moment. My solo show in Mexico City at Bikini Wax, I think, is another seminal moment. A smaller but important seminal moment is a solo show at Iceberg Projects in Chicago. But
was that recent?
That was in 2016 or 17 when I first arrived in Chicago. It was wonderful. Anne Goldstein from the Art Institute came to that exhibition and sent me an email saying how wonderful it was. And Anne and all the curators working under her in modern and contemporary were set to come to my studio for a studio visit recently, which we had to cancel because of COVID-19.
Yeah, it's too bad.
So it hasn't happened yet because I'm waiting for that big show at the Art Institute. I shouldn't say that in recording.
Well, please put me on the list, won't you, please? I lived in Chicago for 20 years, so I know the city pretty well.
Agreed.
Well, I think it's wonderful that you had that success and so early in arriving in Chicago. Who's the curator of prints and drawings now?
I don't know their name. I don't know that person. They've done some really amazing shows, an amazing Lee Bontekou show.
I've heard about them. I mean, I knew the former curator of prints and drawings, and suddenly I wanted to get in touch with him, and he was gone.
They did an amazing Frankenthaler.
And I've heard that the shows have been fantastic.
Lee Bontekou, Helen Frankenthaler.
Cool.
Colleen Smith.
Hmm.
Wonderful.
This is an aside before we part. Have you been introduced to the Indigenous artist Andrea Carlson?
No. Where is she based?
She's in Chicago.
Oh, no, I haven't met her. I'd love to meet her.
I'll send an email to the two of you introducing you. I think she should meet you. I would really like her to get connected. And, you know, you obviously have networked well in Chicago and are integral to the art scene there. And she's sort of an outsider still.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she's a great artist, a great human being. I know she has a public art commission she's working on. And she's associated with a group of Indigenous artists in Chicago. I don't know what that organization is, but I promised her I would try to introduce her. So I'm going to introduce her to Monique Maloche, and I wanted to introduce her to somebody from the Art Institute. So may I write to her and,
yes,
and give her your contact information?
I would love that. You know, I'm currently on sabbatical. I didn't mention that to you. And when I come back from being on sabbatical, I am stepping down from the role of dean, and I will be a full-time faculty in painting and drawing. And as I say, I like to bring diverse examples of excellence to my students. So I'd really like to meet her in terms of possibly someone I could bring to meet my students, or I could bring my students.
Oh, that would be fantastic. And I want you two to meet as well.
That would be great.
I think it'd be great. And then lastly, I keep running out of time, but how important do you think drawing is important to every artist's practice?
To every artist's practice. I tell every artist to draw.
Great. I agree.
Even video artists.
Yeah. I think it's so important. So I'm sorry we've already extended way beyond the 45 minutes I told you.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a pleasure to speak with you, Arnold. Thank you so much for this time. I hope to meet with you one day.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
What I will do is I'll transcribe this audio. The full audio will go on my website with a designated page for you with your contact, you know, your website and gallery association. And then I'll extract some of the commentary. And then image of the work, and that'll all be on a page under conversations on my website.
Thank you so much.
So I hope you are well and enjoy yours. How long is your sabbatical going on?
4 years. So it started August 15th. So we're just at the very beginning. So I have, of course, I have things on my calendar,
mm-hmm.
but I do have a year to enjoy this moment.
Yeah. Well, it's probably a good time not to be involved directly with academia. That's got to be a mess right now, I would think.
It's difficult. Even from where I am, I'm watching. I'm watching closely what's going on.
Yeah. Plenty of fuel, though, for some artwork down the road, isn't it, this time?
Yeah.
Great fodder for, and I'm really anticipating a lot of works on paper to be bursting out here over the coming couple of years, because it seems like everybody's going to drawings.
If you find yourself in Chicago, I would really be open to a studio visit to show you. You know, I'm working on things that I can't put it all on my website.
Okay.
But I would love for you to see. There's so much new work on paper that I'm producing.
Well, I would want to see it all. And I'll hope for that opportunity.
Okay, great.
But thank you so much. This has been a real delight, and I wish you well.
Thank you so much, and
I hope the coming exhibitions are very successful.
Thank you,
Arnold. Mm-hmm.
Thank
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.